Well, greetings once again from my living room. It seems like I mentioned last time I did this that I said at one time I wanted to just try it. Well, thanks to COVID and thanks to another exposure in our family, here I am again, beginning to feel more like I'm a preacher at a multi-site church, and you just happen to be one of the off-site campuses. But so far, this time again, we are COVID-free, or at least symptom-free at our house right now. So not sick, we're just out of the abundance of caution after discussing it with Tim and Ken. Staying home this weekend, you know, if somebody is sick, we don't want to pass it on to somebody else. So that's where we're at. We're at home and wishing that we were at church with you all this morning. This morning we will be in Mark chapter 14, beginning at the 43rd verse. But I also want to make mention, if you've got a pen and a paper, or pencil and paper, you might want to write down three more passages of Scripture. I will refer to them, but because of time, I won't read them. The first one is a parallel passage. It's Matthew chapter 26, verses 47 through 56. Another parallel passage is Luke chapter 22, verses 47 through 53. And the third one is a parallel passage from a slightly different view than the three synoptic gospels, and that is John chapter 18, verses 3 through 11. Again, those three passages are Matthew chapter 26, verses 47 through 56, Luke chapter 22, verses 47 through 53, and John chapter 18, verses 3 through 11. This is one of the benefits of being at home, as I get the opportunity, if you've played golf, you've heard the term take a mulligan. Take a mulligan on preaching this sermon to make it a little more of what I wanted it to be. When things go bad, or we sense that things may go bad, we like to go someplace where we feel secure, where we feel safe, where we feel like we're in control. Someplace where we can wrestle with the situation at hand and come to terms with it, whatever that situation might be. That is why when someone close to us dies, we try to get away to deal with those emotions in a way that we feel comfortable. That's why we find a safe interior room when a tornado is coming our way. It's why people board up their homes and drive inland when a hurricane is approaching. And it's why, if you're like it was where I grew up, if you hear that there is a blizzard coming, you go to the store ahead of time and you make purchases of supplies that you're going to need for several days as you wait for the roads to get cleaned out. And that's what we find Jesus doing in Mark chapter 14, following his last meal with his disciples in the upper room. You see, following the singing of the last of those Hillel Psalms that we've talked about the last couple of weeks, Jesus and his disciples head out of Jerusalem and go to the Mount of Olives and to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus is going to a place where he feels comfortable, and a place where there is some security, where there is privacy, where he can pray to the Father and spend time with the Father alone and deal with the situation at hand. And that's where we find Jesus in this morning's text. He's been in the garden, he's spent time in prayer with his Father, and he has come back to his disciples, who he's left a short distance away from himself because things are about to change. And this is what we find beginning at verse 43 in Mark chapter 14. I'll be reading today from the Christian Standard Version of the Bible. And this is what it says. It says, "While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, suddenly arrived. With him was a mob with swords and clubs from the chief priests and scribes and elders. His betrayer had given them a signal. 'This one I kiss,' he said. 'He's the one. Arrest him and take him away under guard.' So when he came, immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Rabbi,' and kissed him. They took hold of him and arrested him. One of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the priest's servant and cut off his ear. Jesus said to them, 'Have you come out with sword and clubs as if I were a criminal to capture me? Every day I was among you teaching in the temple and you didn't arrest me, but the scripture must be fulfilled.' Then they all deserted him and ran away. Now a certain young man wearing nothing but a linen cloth was following him. They caught hold of him, but he left the linen cloth behind and ran away naked." While we see Jesus going somewhere comfortable, he doesn't avoid the situation at hand. Rather, he faces it head on. If we think about what Mark has written here, we begin to see that Jesus is facing the situation head on because of the way it's all set up. You see, Jesus goes someplace familiar. He goes to some place that he's gone before, some place that he's been, and he feels comfortable. Some place that Judas knew. Some place that Judas would think to look for Jesus. In fact, probably the first place that Judas led the crowd from the chief priests and the leaders of the people was to the Garden of Gethsemane. You see, we know this is some place Jesus feels comfortable because he brings his disciples here. He takes three, Peter, James, and John, and he leaves the other eight at some place in the garden. He brings these three a little farther into the garden, and he leaves them, asking them to pray for him, and then he goes a little farther to spend that private time with the Father. Well, while he's spending his time in prayer, the disciples are comfortable enough. The disciples feel safe enough. The disciples feel the situation is great. And they all fall asleep. The 11 disciples fall asleep while Jesus is praying. And that shows us that this is someplace that the disciples have been before. Someplace they feel comfortable. Someplace they feel secure. We also know that it was likely that this is some place that Jesus himself felt comfortable and he came here. But the thing about saying that Jesus comes to some place familiar is the fact that Jesus could have gone anywhere else. There were a lot of places around Jerusalem where Jesus could have gone to get away from the crowds, to get away from the people. But Jesus chose the Garden of Gethsemane because it was some place he felt safe and secure, even though he knew that Judas would follow him. And Judas does follow him. Jesus and his disciples have gone to the garden, and now Judas comes along leading a group of people from the temple. Mark says that it was a mob, but thinking about it as a mob may not be the right case. Because as we read the other accounts, Matthew, Luke, and John, we see that it likely, while they were not a normal posse type group, that it was made up of probably some soldiers from the Antonia Fortress, some of the Romans who were there right on the edge of the temple, as well as probably some of the guards whose responsibility it was to protect the temple precinct. Some of those were probably Levites who weren't priests. They were of the tribe of Levi, but they weren't of the priestly line. Some of them might have been from the priestly line, but they just weren't in the priestly circle that was responsible for carrying out the ministry of the temple. And Judas brings them along, and Mark says that he came up to him and gave him a kiss. He told the people that were coming with him, who were following Judas, says that I'll give you this sign so you know the right one. And Judas comes up, and in a customary manner for a friend to greet another friend in the Middle East, and it's still this way in some cultures and places today, Judas came up to him, probably put his hands on his shoulders, possibly his hands on his face towards the back of his head, and gave him a kiss on the cheek. Maybe both cheeks, but whatever. He greeted him with rabbi, with the word teacher, and the intimacy of a kiss. Today, we might see something similar. It might have been as if Judas came up to Jesus and put out his hand to shake his hand, saying, "Good to see you, friend," and then kind of pulling him in and giving him the bro hug. That we're friends, and while we're not going to get an intimate type hug, we'll give each other that response of friendship and camaraderie and that kind of a hug. Because Judas doesn't want Jesus to be misidentified. Judas doesn't want anybody else to be identified as Jesus. Because here's the thing. It's in the middle of the night. We don't know exactly how long, but late in the night. And so probably it was dark. Dark in this olive grove. And so Judas wanted to make sure that the people who were with him knew the right person to arrest, because Judas wanted to make sure he got paid. John and the other gospel writers inform us that Judas was, well, he was in charge of the money for the disciple band, and at times he put his hand into the pocket or into the purse on his own. And this was just an opportunity for Judas to get a kickback from the time that he'd spent with Jesus. And so he wanted to make sure that things did not go amiss. Well, Jesus knew what was happening. Jesus knew what was going to happen. And yet he still chose to go to Gethsemane. And in spite of what it might look like, Jesus is in charge of the situation. Jesus is in control of what is going to happen. We can say that because of several things we see in Jesus. The first, we've already mentioned the fact that he went to the Garden of Gethsemane, though he could have gone a lot of other places. Jesus, though he knew Judas was going to betray him. In fact, if you read the stories of the Last Supper, you find that Jesus predicted to the group of 12 that one of them would betray him. They questioned him who it was, and Jesus identified Judas so that Judas would know that Jesus knew what Judas was about to do. He predicted the betrayal of Judas, but he still goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. And not by accident. Jesus also betrays, prophesies, predicts the scattering of the disciples. Yet he chooses to bring them with him, and he chooses to bring them into this intimate place and in this situation. We also see Jesus in control of the situation because he begins to ask questions. Jesus begins to ask questions of the group. He says, "Have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were a criminal to capture me?" Elsewhere, John tells us that Jesus asked, "Who are you looking for?" And when they gave him an answer, he said, "I am he." Jesus was asking questions. Jesus was keeping things in control, even though it doesn't necessarily look like it. Jesus also, we see him not just asking questions about who they're looking for, but he also asks, "Why didn't you arrest me earlier? Why haven't you taken this opportunity as I was teaching all week in the temple courts?" And then Matthew, in his gospel, gives us the indication, another indication, that Jesus was in control. Because Matthew says, well, as the old hymn says, that he could have called 10,000 angels. Matthew tells us that Jesus says, "I could have asked my Father, and he would have put at my disposal 10,000 angels. He would have provided for me everything I needed for my protection. I could have called at this very minute for help, and there was nothing you could have done to arrest me. But I am giving myself into your hands." We see it also in Jesus' interaction with the disciples and the way the disciples look at the situation and what takes place. You see, if you look at Luke, the account in Luke, it says that there was this conversation between the disciples and Jesus about the use of force. "Jesus, we have two swords. Should we defend you?" And Jesus is in control of the situation. But before Jesus has an opportunity to ask, Peter does what Peter does. Mark tells us that someone took out a sword and struck one of the group that was coming to Jesus, the servant of the high priest. But if you look at John chapter 18, verse 10, John gives us two interesting pieces of information that really lend credibility to the story, because it's not something you would tell about a friend unless it was true. It's not a story you would make up to make your group of friends look better. But in John chapter 18, verses 10 and 11, John tells us that it was Peter who took out his sword and cut off the ear of Malchus. He names the servant of the high priest, not just the one doing the cutting off of the ear, but the one who had his ears cut off. And we don't know why he includes the name Malchus. There's a possibility. You look at some of the things that John does and the times that John gives names of minor characters or part actors in the story, and you'd say that there is probably a good possibility that Malchus might have become a disciple of Jesus. That Malchus started following Jesus, or else the story was told and Malchus became famous enough that just telling the story later, the name Malchus lends credibility. But we don't know why John for sure gives the name, but he does. Peter, as we look at this, one of the things that we realize about Peter is, though Jesus is coming to this place on purpose, Peter doesn't understand that Jesus must be taken into captivity. into custody, and that Jesus is going to go through these trials, and Jesus is going to end up on the cross at Gethsemane, or at Golgotha. You see, Peter doesn't understand this, even though Jesus has told them time and again in very specific details at times. Peter doesn't understand it. But also, we see Peter doing this, and I like what Craig Evans, professor and author, says. He says, it's very likely, well, this is not a direct quote, this is my narrowing down what he says. He said basically that Peter might have been trying to show his loyalty to Jesus in the face of Jesus' prediction of his coming betrayal. Because Peter didn't understand what Jesus was doing, and Peter said, oh, Jesus, I'll go with you even to death. Well, now the crowds come, or the police, I guess, for a better word, come to take Jesus into custody, and Peter, trying to say to Jesus, see, I am with you, takes his sword and cuts off the ear of Malchus. But Jesus, being in charge of the situation, takes the ear. Actually, it doesn't even say he takes the ear, it just says he touched the side of Malchus's head where the ear was and healed Malchus. And as he heals Malchus, which we read about in Luke chapter 22, we read in John chapter 18 that Jesus reprimands Peter. Jesus says to Peter, that is not how we're going to fight this. That's not how this situation is going to be resolved. And then the disciples scatter. Jesus has been arrested, but the disciples scattered. And Mark gives us one more piece of information that we wish we knew so much more about. That there is this young boy who's dressed in nothing but a linen sheet, and somebody from the arresting group grabs that sheet, and this young boy runs away naked. You don't put those kinds of details in a story unless there's a reason. That for some reason this is a memorable chap. And maybe he became a disciple or a follower of Jesus and became a Christian, and his story is well known. And so to add credibility, Mark just tells his story without giving him a name, just this young lad. Perhaps there was something else about it that the early Christians would have known from the telling of the story over and over again. But Mark just says that, like the rest of the disciples, this young boy ran away. And then we have the mob. The mob shows us that Jesus is in charge. Believe it or not, the fact that the mob is there and the way we see things take place from the mob tells us that Jesus is in charge. Because we know that they only arrest Jesus because he lets them. It goes back to Matthew chapter 26. Jesus could have called 10,000 angels. Jesus could have stepped in and done something in that way. There were other times when they tried to take Jesus by force and make him his king, or tried to throw him off the edge of a cliff, where Jesus just somehow, some way, walks through the crowd, disappears from the crowd. Jesus could have done this in the Garden of Gethsemane. It's dark anyway. Could they really have all followed very well? But Jesus, in talking to the mob, he says to them in Luke chapter 22, verse 53, he says, but this is your hour. You could have arrested me in the temple, but this is your hour, when darkness reigns. Jesus is telling us something about the story, that though they're the ones arresting him, that they're not necessarily the ones who are really causing the situation, because darkness is reigning. And so Jesus only allows them to, or they only arrest him because Jesus allows him. But it also, we see this in the sarcasm. We miss in English the sarcasm that is present in this story, in what's taking place. Especially if you're reading the NIV, because the NIV says in verse 48, it says, "You've come to me as if I were leading a rebellion." When we see that, we miss the contact with the previous encounter. Because the Greek word here is leistes. And it means a criminal or a robber. And it is the same word that Jesus used back in Mark chapter 11, verse 17, in the story of the cleansing of the temple, when Jesus says that you have made my Father's house a den of leistes, robbers. It's the same word. Jesus is saying to them, I taught in the temple that you were robbing the people of God and thus robbing God. But you didn't arrest me then. But now you've come out and you are treating me as a leistes, a robber, when you are the ones who deserve this treatment. You see, Jesus is saying basically, you deserve the treatment that I am receiving. And just as a major storm can cause a major change in our lives, and I'm not just talking physical storms, but physical storms, yes, emotional, spiritual storms as well. But a physical storm can cause some changes in our lives. The loss of a house. The loss of our possessions. A change in residence. And even a loss of life. So this moment in Jesus' story is going to alter everything going forward. Because up until this point, Jesus has had his disciples around him, and he's had the crowds on his side. But now the crowd that has gathered is the crowd that has been sent by the chief priests and the leaders of the people from the Roman guard that is in the city for Passover, and from their guards that take care of the temple precincts. They have sent this crowd. A crowd that is hostile to Jesus. And in this moment, the disciples flee. Oh yes, Peter and John follow from a distance. Peter follows at least through the trials at Annas's and Caiaphas's residence. And John, it looks like, goes ahead and follows Jesus, even to being present at the cross. But they don't follow in companionship. They follow out of concern, out of fear. Unlike the companionship that they've had with Jesus, from this point forward, Jesus is going to be in isolation. Jesus is going to be alone amidst a hostile crowd. But Jesus, we see in the story, Jesus is focused on the work of the Father. Jesus is focused on doing what he came to do, and therefore, Therefore, Jesus faces this time alone. And he is in control. While we're never going to face situations like Jesus in this moment, there are at least two things from this situation that we need to remember. Two things from this situation that will help us when we face difficult trials, when we face the storms of life in our own lives. The first one is that God did not keep Jesus from despair. Jesus was not protected or taken out of the despair that he was to face. And there are times and situations in life when we don't understand what God is doing and why God is allowing things. But we, like Jesus, can know that God is there with us, even when he allows these difficult times to come. And the second thing that we need to see is that Jesus was in control of the situation, even when the immediate situation and the immediate circumstances made it seem otherwise. When we face these challenges and trials in life, we need to remember that God is in control. Even if we may not see it, even if we may not understand it, God is in control. Jesus is in control. And therefore, we can face the challenges of life, even if we don't understand, because God is in control. And God will go with us through the difficulties. I know that we all face these challenges in our lives, but the good news is that God cares. And just as Jesus had to face the challenges of the trials and the abuse and the cross, that even if we face the challenging aspects of life, that if we are a follower of Jesus, that God is with us. And what a great promise that is. This morning, if you don't know Jesus as your Savior, let me tell you that it doesn't mean we're going to go through life perfect if we put our trust in him. It just means that we have one who is greater than anything we can face, to carry us, to take us through those trials. And sometimes even to push them aside. And if you don't know him as your Savior, I would encourage you to stop somebody on your way out of church. And whoever you stop will be glad to point you to somebody who would have that conversation about what a relationship with Jesus Christ looks like and what it means and how to start that. And if you don't feel comfortable doing that, find my number. Find an email address for me and get in touch with me. I'd love to visit with you. But I also know that many of us this morning are followers of Jesus Christ who've already began that relationship. And more than anything, sometimes we just need the reminder that God is with us, that God cares about us and loves us and wants for us good, and that he will be with us.